This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, October 23rd, 2008. From Washington, D.C., I'm Leanne Caldwell, sitting in for Otto Bogato. In today's newscast, the government is requesting more personal information from air travelers, senators wonder if the bailout will wipe out small banks, and rights for same-sex couples are in jeopardy in California. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. This morning, a Wisconsin judge threw out a lawsuit that questioned the eligibility of thousands on voter rolls in Wisconsin. Molly Stentz reports from WORT Radio in Madison.
Earlier this year, the state of Wisconsin cross-checked their database of voters as required by the new Federal Help America Vote Act. They found thousands of names in the state voter file that didn't match DMV records due to misspellings, typos, and middle initials. The state elections agency found those voters could be forced to re-register at the polls or use provisional ballots, so they decided not to use it. The state attorney general, a Republican and co-chair of the McCain campaign in Wisconsin, sued to force the state to use the cross-check data and purge those people from the rolls. But today's ruling throws out that case. Lester Pines, attorney for the state elections agency, referred to as the Government Accountability Board, spoke outside the crowded courtroom today.
The Government Accountability Board was right, and the Republican Party and the attorney general were wrong. The United States Attorney General has the right to seek to enforce the federal law. No other entity has the right to bring a lawsuit about the Help America Vote Act, period.
In the motion to dismiss the case, the judge cited Wisconsin's long history of protecting the right to vote, regardless of clerical errors. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Molly Stentz from WORT-FM in Madison.
In other legal news, U.S. District Court Judge Neil Wake has ruled against the infamous Maricopa County, Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio. The judge said the conditions in the Maricopa County jail are unconstitutional and put the health and safety of prisoners at risk. Margaret Winter, associate director of the ACLU's National Prison Project, says the ruling covers pretrial inmates who have not been convicted of a crime.
In theory, only they will get the benefit of this ruling, the ones who have not yet been convicted. In reality, if, for example, you change the whole mental health care and health care system and the food is made safe, it's going to end up affecting everyone the same.
For more than 6 years, the sheriff sought to avoid a federal decree demanding he improve conditions at the jail to constitutional minimums. The ACLU calls the decision a sweeping rebuff of Arpaio's efforts. In a show of how poor conditions in the jails are, Judge Wake ordered that inmates be given basic medical and mental health care, as well as access to prescribed medications and basic necessities like toilets and toilet paper, soap, and food that meets federal guidelines. Now, according to Winter, comes the enforcement of the ruling.
It's certainly not it for this case in that to make this a reality so that it's not just a piece of paper, but so that it's a living reality that changes the lives of the detainees. So it's going to mean enforcing it, which means ongoing litigation.
The ACLU says conditions in the jails have caused terrible suffering to inmates and that even the toughest sheriff in America has to abide by the Constitution. Amnesty and human rights groups around the world are calling for the release of two women who were arrested last week in Zimbabwe when a peaceful protest was dispersed violently by police. The activists are members of the grassroots organization Women of Zimbabwe Arise. Their protest called for the stabilization of the government, which is currently struggling to implement a power-sharing deal, and food relief for the millions suffering as the country's economy fails. Witnesses to the protests say police attacked the women with batons as they waited for government officials to hear their demands. Amnesty International is calling Jenny Williams and Magodanga Malangu prisoners of conscience. The EU has given its top human rights award to Chinese activist Hu Jia. He was jailed in China after testifying before the EU Assembly last year about human rights violations in the country. Today, the Chinese Foreign Ministry denounced the EU for awarding the Sakharov Prize to Hu, calling him a criminal. And a record number of people have died this year from prescription drug use. According to the medical watchdog group Safe Medication Practices, nearly 5,000 people are dead and over 20,000 people suffered injuries associated with prescription drugs. This is a 38% increase from last year. The main culprits are the anti-smoking drug varenicline and the blood thinner heparin. The heparin cases are linked to contaminated batches of the drug imported from China. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. I'm Jess Burns in Eugene, Oregon.
When you fly, the government will now ask for your full legal name, gender, and birthday. Not to give you special deals on your special day, but they say it's to make sure you are not the same Susan Smith or Jay Jones on the no-fly list. The program is called Secure Flight. Airlines will require the information and pass it on to the TSA, the Transportation Security Administration. Joining us to talk about this program is Tim Sparapani, Senior Counsel at the American Civil Liberties Union. Is there anything wrong with handing over this additional information?
Well, what's interesting is that for the first time, they're claiming that they need a birth date. And that's really interesting because we've always been led to believe in conversations we've had with officials in Washington, D.C., that the government didn't actually keep dates of birth as part of its watch list process. So this is actually a new piece of data, and it's unclear exactly how giving that date of birth will help differentiate between two people with same or similar names. But that's at least the claim. Secondly, with respect to gender, some individuals who are transgendered will have difficulty, of course, presenting in one gender where they might have a birth certificate or another document, or more importantly, a government file with information that suggests that they have a separate gender.
The government says that this is to remove names on the no-fly list that don't belong there. They haven't needed gender or date of birth before, but the government has been compiling all of this information for years for this so-called no-fly list. Where do they currently get that information?
Well, let's back up for a second. They're actually not going to be removing names from the list. Rather, what they're going to be doing is when people go to register to fly, they're going to be comparing people who are making reservations to a list that's already established. And so by asking for additional information, what they're going to do is run that additional information against the database and against the watch list. In general, to get the information, the government does all sorts of intelligence gathering, some of which we would not find objectionable, some of which, of course, we find very objectionable. The problem with the watch list is that it's never been vetted. No one knows how you get yourself on the watch list. No one knows how to get oneself off the watch list. So we have people whose names are appearing on the watch list who are simply deemed suspicious by the government. It's very different than what would be necessary under the Fourth Amendment to go ahead and arrest or even investigate somebody fully. So we have a list based on suspicion, which is being used to deny people exercise of their constitutional rights to move freely throughout our society.
Are you concerned that now that the airlines have to hand over all of this information, is the government going to get this information on every passenger or only on requested passengers? How is that going to work? And could it possibly be just this gigantic database of anyone who decides to take a flight?
Now, this will be requested of every single person every single time they try to fly, domestically or internationally eventually. So there will be a fair amount of data recorded about people.
Is there anything possibly that's good that can come out of this?
Well, there are some things that are improvements over past versions of this proposed program. We're calling this Secure Flight 3.0. This is really sort of their third iteration of this program, and it's taken them almost 8 years to get it to this stage. One of the things they're not doing anymore, which they should be commended for and which we've insisted upon, is they are not using commercially held databases about Americans to vet people for flying. That's a very good thing. They are also, again at our insistence, no longer giving people a risk score based on some unknown algorithm based on, you know, assumptions they might make about somebody's behavior outside of flying that they would think would cause them to be suspicious. The real problem that remains here is they've never dealt with the fundamental underlying problem, which is the watch list itself. Nobody knows how people get on that list. Nobody knows, again, how to get off that list. There's no way to vet it. Congress hasn't seen it. And there are too many thousands of innocent law-abiding Americans who are finding that their names are either on the list or they have a name that's similar enough to somebody who's on the list that they're going to get captured in future dragnets whenever they try to fly.
That was Tim Sparapani, senior counsel at the American Civil Liberties Union in Washington, D.C. On Capitol Hill today, a Senate panel quizzed Neel Kashkari, the Treasury official in charge of spending $700 billion taxpayer dollars on Wall Street. Lawmakers want assurance that the banks will use the money to loosen credit and issue loans, not to expand the bank's personal portfolio. The questions arise one day after Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson said banks might use government money to buy smaller banks. FSRN's Karen Miller reports.
At the hearing, Kashkari talked about the government's new capital purchase program. In the program, the Treasury will purchase up to $250 billion in preferred stock from qualifying banks. According to the Treasury, the money is supposed to provide capital for banks to lend and not to hoard. But some on the committee question if that will be the case. Chairman Chris Dodd, Democrat from Connecticut.
What can you tell us, what guarantees, what assurances, what commitments are the Treasury going to extract from these lending institutions that they're not going to do this other than rhetorically begging them not to do it? I think we need more than just begging.
Kashkari said the terms surrounding the preferred stock agreements would give provisions on how banks can and cannot use the capital. First, there would not be an increase in dividends on the stocks purchased.
Because we don't think it's appropriate to take government capital, the taxpayers' money, and then increase dividends. That doesn't increase capital in the financial system, so that's prohibited.
Second, Kashkari said that share buybacks would not be allowed.
We don't want to put government capital in and then boost the stock price by buying back a bunch of shares. That's contractually prohibited.
But Kashkari was vague on what the Treasury was going to do to make sure banks actually use the money for lending.
In addition, we've got other language in there focusing on commitments around increasing lending, working hard to help homeowners. Some of them are contractual provisions. Others are more in guidance in nature, but we share your view 100%. We want these institutions in our communities lending.
Kashkari said the Treasury did not put out guidelines because they would not be legally binding, and they didn't want to micromanage how banks use their money. However, committee chair members weren't satisfied. Charles Schumer, Democrat of New York.
What are you going to do for banks that don't increase their lending at all, that take this capital?
Sure. As I mentioned previously, Senator, I think that the provisions on preventing dividend increases and stopping share buybacks provides very strong incentive for these institutions to want to lend again.
But we've had a couple of leading executives talk about they think that the banks, and they were talking not about their own specific institution alone, are going to just sort of hoard the money for a while. And they thought that was in their best interest, and that worries me.
It worries us, too. We want these institutions to lend, absolutely, but also recognize the situation we're all in right now is a situation of unprecedented lack of confidence in the system.
Understood.
And so the immediate reactions may be more reserved. I think as the markets begin to sort themselves out, I would expect to see these institutions lending.
I would urge you to consider putting out these guidelines. And then there's one that may be easier. What about guidelines inveighing against new investments in these exotic financial instruments that brought so many of the institutions down to begin with?
Not wanting to be overly prescriptive and keeping away the health.
But as I said, I think you're leaning too far in giving them dessert and not enough in making them eat their vegetables.
Currently, 9 major banks are on board to receive $125 billion, with the rest of the funds going to smaller banks that qualify. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
While massive banking institutions like Wachovia, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, and others hope to weather this financial storm, alternative lenders who avoided the pitfalls that have brought down the big banks appear to be as strong as ever. They say credit is flowing and business is good, but some microfinance institutions and affordable homeownership organizations are feeling some of the pain as the impacts do trickle down from Wall Street. FSRN's Tanya Snyder reports.
In the midst of a financial disaster, is this what you expect to hear from a lending institution?
Our portfolios, our loans, are performing quite well.
Our buyers have an extremely low rate of foreclosure.
We're in a very strong financial position. We're not restricted right now.
The financial crisis doesn't affect all players equally. David Beck works for a Community Development Financial Institution, or CDFI, in North Carolina, called the Center for Community Self-Help. He says that CDFIs like his are counter-cyclical, meaning that when traditional banks are hurting, they're doing well.
Our ability to help is actually gone up. I think the issue is that there's so much more to do.
CDFIs have largely been able to avert the problems of the credit market with a few key principles guiding their lending. They underwrite their loans more cautiously. They educate their borrowers better and maintain closer relationships with them. And the Center for Community Self-Help maintains a 4-to-1 leveraging ratio. Beck explains what that means.
By comparison, I think Lehman Brothers was leveraged at 33-to-1. Fannie Mae was leveraged at 40-to-1. And so they had a very small cushion in retrospect, a too small cushion. If loans started defaulting and they had to pay all those defaults, they didn't have enough liquidity to actually pay folks back.
As the credit market sees up, fewer people can get loans from the big traditional banks, and that brings more business to CDFIs. And since they've been lending conservatively with a sound foundation, their default rates are still under 1%. Compare that to about 25% of subprime loans that are delinquent or in foreclosure, according to numbers released by Friedman Billings Ramsey, an investment bank based in Arlington, Virginia. So CDFIs still have plenty of money to lend out. Mark Pinsky of the Opportunity Finance Network, a national coalition of CDFIs, says that the fundamentals of good credit do matter.
If there's a lesson of CDFIs, it's that it's possible to lend profitably and responsibly in markets that are outside the mainstream, right? It is possible to move the margins, right?
The CDFIs in Pinsky's network are also seeing an upsurge in business now. Around the country, community banks and alternative lending institutions have been an oasis from stormy economic times. According to experts from the New America Foundation, the failure rate among big banks is 8 times greater than among small banks so far this year. Many small community banks have been offered a piece of the $700 billion bailout pie and have turned it down, saying that they're performing as well as ever and they don't need any help. This is not to say that everything is rosy. With an economic downturn as severe as this one, there are bound to be ramifications. CDFIs and home ownership organizations that work with low-income people will likely see some of their clients struggle to pay back their loans. Tracy Ward works for Self-Help's commercial lending division.
Small businesses are struggling. Their customers are tightening their belts. Their food costs are higher. Fuel costs are higher.
Meg Burns works for Housing and Urban Development, helping low-income homebuyers get access to mortgages. Just because home prices are crashing, she says, doesn't mean that it's easier to buy.
Mortgage insurance companies can't stay in markets where at the time that the property is purchased, the value is, say, $100,000, and then a few years later, the value has declined to $80,000, and potentially the mortgage insurance company has to pick up that loss and cover that loss. So in some of those markets that are declining, the private mortgage insurance companies have pulled out.
The problems don't end there. MANA is a local affordable homeownership organization in Washington, D.C. They build housing and then sell it at an affordable rate to low-income buyers. So the credit problems have affected them on both ends. They have a harder time getting loans to do the construction on buildings, and then their prospective buyers have a harder time getting loans to buy them. Still, MANA director George Rothman says their clients disprove the myth that low-income people are more likely to default on loans.
Many low-income people have done extremely well because they've gotten 30-year fixed-rate loans. It's responsible lending. It's not the income. And actually, home buyer education also is a big component. Our buyers understand what they're getting into.
When asked if the bailout would help MANA and its clients, Rothman says it doesn't directly help them as much as it helps the big Wall Street firms. But he adds anything that helps increase liquidity in general will benefit his organization. And more than just a quick fix, alternative lenders note that the government is redefining how the financial marketplace works. They can't help but notice that the new rules will probably look something like the rules they've been working with the whole time. For FSRN, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. Find us online at fsrn.org. Tune into FSRN tomorrow when we bring coverage of the third-party presidential debates moderated by Chris Hedges tonight in Washington, D.C. Two candidates have confirmed participation, Ralph Nader and Chuck Baldwin of the Constitution Party. Join us tomorrow and every day. You're listening to FSRN. In campaign news, Barack Obama has left the campaign trail to visit his ailing grandmother in Hawaii. His wife, Michelle, will take his place on the road. He's expected to return to the campaign Saturday. As November 4th, Election Day, approaches, voters in states around the country will vote on ballot initiatives. In California, one initiative is on same-sex marriage. Same-sex couples are currently enjoying new equal marriage rights in the state. But if Proposition 8 passes, it would be an enormous step backwards in their long struggle for equality under the law. Eric Klein has this story.
Polly Pagenhart married her partner Jennifer just a month after the California Supreme Court cleared the way for same-sex couples to wed this June.
I'm still getting used to digesting that, by the way. I mean, it was just, we did it on our 14th anniversary this past July.
Pagenhart blogs about parenting and politics at lesbiandad.net. She has two kids, both were carried to term by her partner, and the status of same-sex parents and their rights is foremost in her mind, especially when it comes to planning a family vacation outside of California, where there could be an increased risk of not being recognized as the mother of her children.
We've got them all X'd out on the map, like little sad faces, smiley faces, Connecticut, Massachusetts, New York, sad faces, Florida, Utah. So we would zigzag across the country if we took a road trip.
California's Proposition 8, if passed, would change the state constitution to eliminate the right of same-sex couples to marry and provide that only a marriage between a man and a woman is valid or recognized in California. Polly Pagenhart says that she's aware of some of the smaller legal and financial losses she and her family could face if Proposition 8 passes and their new marriage reverts back to a domestic partnership, but it's still the loss of equality that carries the greatest weight.
The position of being recognized by the state as an equal is kind of breathtaking when it's, for gay people, it's the state that has been the very source of one of our greatest fears, especially for people who have families. The frightening scenario of somebody at a hospital keeping you from seeing your partner or your children in the worst case scenario because they have because you are not recognized as immediate family is the worst possible thing.
Proposition 8 is the latest effort in a struggle over same-sex marriage in California. In 2000, voters passed a similar ban, which led to a series of court challenges, culminating in the state Supreme Court ruling that denying same-sex couples equal marriage rights was unconstitutional. This time, gay marriage opponents are using Prop 8 to change the state constitution. Bishop George McKinney is one of those opponents. He's a San Diego pastor who debated in favor of Prop 8 recently on the KPFA morning show. He says he's fighting to protect the sanctity of marriage.
The groups that have come together are those groups that hold a common worldview, and I must be open about this. Our worldview is shaped by the Judeo-Christian tradition.
40% of the nearly $23 million raised by the Yes on 8 campaign has been from members of the Mormon Church, with some of that money coming from out of state, paying for TV ads that largely focus on elementary schools, teaching homosexuality in the classroom if Prop 8 loses.
After Massachusetts legalized gay marriage, our son came home and told us the school taught him that boys can marry other boys. He's in second grade.
We tried to stop public schools from teaching children.
Karen Anderson is a board member of the East Bay Lesbian and Gay Democratic Club. She and her wife, Gwen Bouzet, were married mere hours after the state Supreme Court ruling in a ceremony officiated by Oakland Mayor Ron Dellums with Congressmember Barbara Lee as a witness.
Well, it's a great feeling.
Anderson is retired from military service as well as employment with the federal government. Despite being legally married in California, her wife is still denied the federal benefits given to heterosexual spouses because of the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act passed by Congress. If Prop 8 passes, it would be an enormous setback for Anderson. She would prefer to move forward towards federal marriage equality.
Having California recognize our relationship as a lifetime commitment and a legal one, of course, we want to pursue our federal benefits.
Anderson and her wife are both African American, and she doesn't hesitate to draw a parallel to the civil rights struggles of the 60s for racial equality.
So we've been through the struggle of just being recognized as human beings that have civil rights. For us, the struggle for same-sex marriage is a civil right. There's no reason for us to be categorized any differently than anyone else.
In 1968, a full year after interracial marriage was legal in this country, a 1968 Gallup poll found that 80% of Americans were against interracial marriage.
Dr. Davina Katulski is the former executive director of Marriage Equality USA and the author of the book, Why You Should Give a Damn About Gay Marriage.
80%, a full year after it was marriage. Can you imagine if we had voted on that? We would have taken, a majority should never vote on the rights of a minority.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eric Klein.
In Colombia, thousands of indigenous people are staging a week-long march. Marchers plan to cross 70 miles of Colombia's countryside. They say they want to change economic policies that are impoverishing their nation. They're rejecting the presence of U.S. corporations on their lands. Manuel Ruada joined the march as it passed through Colombia's Cauca province.
The march was joined by some 10,000 natives from a dozen different nations. As they climbed a steep section of the Pan American Highway, a youth group chanted anti-government slogans. They carried cardboard coffins to denounce the recent killings of native leaders by armed groups. Feliciano Valencia is a spokesman for the Nasa Nation.
We're going to ask the government to do away with its security policies and with all the terror it is generating. We are asking them to eject multinationals or to stop them from entering indigenous territories. We are rejecting U.S. intervention under the guise of Plan Colombia.
The Center for International Policy says that over the past 6 years, Colombia has received over $5 billion in U.S. military aid. Much of this money has been used to destroy drug trafficking operations through the Plan Colombia initiative. The Colombian military has also stepped up its campaign against guerrilla groups who finance themselves through the drug trade. But some indigenous farmers grow illegal crops like the coca leaf and the poppy flower to supplement their meager incomes. And this means that many communities have been affected by the government's war on drugs. Luis Olmos is a member of the Yamacubo Nation.
Plan Colombia has hit us hard because they have sprayed our good crops with glyphosate when they're trying to eradicate the illegal ones. They damage the land, they damage the food and the water. The land does not produce as much as before, and this generates hunger and poverty.
Indigenous leaders say that the military operations are forcing natives off their lands. And they claim the government is doing it on purpose. Many nations are based in areas rich in natural resources, like water, timber, and gold, says one NASA elder. And over the past decade, Colombia's Congress has been passing laws that make it easier for multinationals to profit from such resources. The government says that foreign investment will generate employment in the countryside. But demonstrators would rather live off the land. They want to discuss their proposals with President Uribe next week. Manuel Rueda, FSRN, Bogotá.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. For Catherine Comp, Vinod K. Jose, Jess Burns, Rose Kadopchi, and Puck Lowe, I'm Leanne Caldwell in Washington, D.C.